A little less of that, more of the wave. Tuesday night.
No way.
Yeah. All right, it's picking, well, it's picking you guys up just fine.
So okay, great.
I will let you guys
have
go to
safe
it.
Safe trip.
Be well. Holler at me when you get back.
Yeah, and I'll pick. Unless you bring it over to Steam, you don't have to bring it over to Steam, but if you want to, you can.
I'll look at my schedule. Okay, thanks.
All right.
This is Vicky Tobias, second oral history interview with Dick Wagner, February 14th, 2008. We're in Memorial Library, and I think interviewing our notes from our last interview, and one of the things that I was thinking about since we talked last that I think is really interesting and intriguing and perhaps a good way to kind of segue from our last interview to today's talk. You talked a lot about activism and activism in Madison and for the LGBT community, how critical it was that you had already established some inroads into local government, and because of that, the experience was very different in Madison, and perhaps you could maybe elaborate on that a bit more.
Okay. Part of it was that through the anti-war movement, so many people got involved in local politics in Wisconsin. There were people who were early on running for local elected officials, Paul Soglin for the city council, then two other students got elected to the city council, Dennis McGilligan and Gene Parks, and then there was an effort to not only sort of change the student wards, but to change the kind of people who run the city council in the outlying areas as well. Madison has always been known as a democratic town, relatively, quote, progressive, but it was not radical in the sense that the anti-war movement sort of changed it. And so some of the old-time Dems were, you know, good labor union Dems, nothing wrong, but they didn't have the sort of same, we're trying to change society in sort of some fundamental ways. And then Mitch Miller out of the McCarthy campaign ran for the state legislature, got elected, and then other people started to also replace other people. Back then, actually, Madison's West Side had a Republican legislator, which is remarkable when you think of sort of that area today.
Demographic.
Right, but demographics change a whole lot. And I can remember one of my friends in 79 was sort of moving to the east side across the R, and he ended up replacing a one of those old long-time, you know, labor-type Dems, and bringing, you know, a different, more activist kind of progressive agenda to things. So part of it was a natural sort of cycling. Part of it was the openness of the local systems and the state system even. I mean, basically back then an assembly race was about $10,000. You know, you could raise that relatively easily in this town. Today they're probably hundreds of thousands in big contested seats, but
sure.
So a number of us decided that, you know, we could run for local office. My first try was that aldermanic race when McGilligan left, and which I didn't win, but came close. So I moved to a more promising area of what I thought, and sort of put that behind me, and then ran for the 6th district where I got elected. And actually, in the end, in an uncontested election. And that was sort of part of the gay mafia at work. It was going to be an open seat. Some friends of mine from the Historical Society had sort of persuaded me to get involved in their local political machine. They had, at that point, elected Mike Christopher, who was the alder, and Mike Nowakowski, who was the county supervisor. And they were very heavily involved in the Marquette Neighborhood Association, which was the big neighborhood in the district. And so they got me involved in the Neighborhood Association. I became vice president and then president of the Neighborhood Association. So, and therefore they were grooming me for this potential race. And then Mike Nowakowski decided he wasn't gonna run again for the county board. they persuaded me that that's what I ought to run for, and so I said yes and did, and decided to. And I was getting nomination papers, and David Clarenbach, who had been on the county board, who had been a roommate of mine briefly in the Mansion Hill area, went out with nomination papers all around the address of this one potential opponent who had surfaced. Mm-hmm. So when this guy decided he was going to run, everybody said, well, they already signed papers for Dick Wagner, and that, you know. So he, in the end, decided not to run.
Sure.
So,
very clever.
Right. So again, you were using skills and networks to help build this, which later we would call more formally or jokingly the Hamann turn. and, you know, sort of after the quote, common turn for the Communist International, this was sort of the Homosexual International.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a way of encouraging folks within the gay and lesbian community to mm-hmm. run for office and be supportive of them while they were there. So
it seems to me, though, as I'm listening to you talk,
right.
the, you were all already very skilled in political strategy.
Oh, yes.
And you know, two or three steps ahead of perhaps
right.
other communities that didn't have a community of folks who are already well-versed in those
right.
strategies and tactics to get people elected to office. And like you talked about working from within the system.
Right. And, you know, my, as I said, I came from a mildly Democratic family
mm-hmm.
in terms of my father being, you know, marginally involved in politics. But most of, and this is when I got involved with helping form the National Association for Gay and Lesbian Elected Officials,
mm-hmm.
many of them came from a slightly more activist background, but they were never the biggest activist, who always tended to have slightly more of an outsider point of view. And so, like, one of the people who I was able to encourage to join me on the county board was Kathleen Nichols.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been involved in a lot of activist things earlier in the 70s, but at that point was living in another East Side district over in the Tenney Lapham area.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ran. She had a contested race, and the campaign literature distributed against her was really sort of a smear, do you really want a lesbian representing you?
Interesting.
And so this is 82, and so somebody thought that would still have purchase in 82.
Did it?
It didn't.
Mm-hmm.
She got elected with a very substantial margin. So, and then Kathleen and I both were involved in future county board elections, and when a group of progressives from labor and ourselves sort of representing the gay and lesbian community, or parts of it by any means, there were certainly other folks, met to sort of talk about those upcoming elections, is where I first met Tammy,
mm-hmm.
who came and joined.
Tammy
of,
Baldwin.
Tammy
correct.
Baldwin,
okay.
Yes. Excuse
Everyone
me.
Refers
right,
to her
right,
as
right,
like
Tammy,
Cher,
right, right,
you know.
Right, right. Yes, like Cher, right, right.
It's
right.
Just Tammy.
Tammy,
yeah.
Right. Where, you know, after we had sort of the initial general meeting and we talked about strategy for getting progressives elected
mm-hmm.
To the spring offices, she came and we broke into caucuses, and so Kathleen and I were sort of like the gay and lesbian caucus, and here comes Tammy to join us, and we hadn't met her before. She had just sort of come to this progressive meeting from
uh-huh.
sort of her background, and so, you know, that was sort of a way for her to meet us and sort of us to sort of course, encourage her to run
right.
Later
on. What was
on.
She doing at that time?
I think she had finished her schoolwork and was back here. It was in a law practice. You know, she, yes, because she, when she was on the county board, she was in her law practice.
Right.
So,
okay. Interesting.
So, you know, sort of that was sort of her sort of political coming out. And,
mm-hmm.
So then in 86, we got her elected to the board, too. And so it was, you know, that's kind of a process of encouraging and recruiting folks. And the city council had a whole range of folks, too. And as
yeah.
I said, at one point, we had more than any other place in the country in this one little community.
In our one little
right.
island of... How would you characterize the environment for LGBT in the early 80s?
It was actually pretty open. You know, Madison back then certainly had a liberal political establishment. You know, I mean, in the late 60s and early 70s, those fights had occurred, and basically it was over by then within the city. County was a little more tenuous, but pretty clearly established and trending.
You talked a little bit about the smear campaign against Kathleen Nichols.
Right.
Were there other incidents like that still occurring in the early 80s, or has had there ever been?
Well, I mean, I got various hate mail, you know,
yeah,
in my early stages,
yeah,
from folks. You know, I can remember even later when the Hotel Washington burned down.
Right.
There was a prayer service vigil at the Methodist Campus Center, and a whole bunch of the local Phelps types, Fred Phelps, the minister,
oh, right,
and stuff like that, were there and shouting at us for, you know, sort of trying to have a prayer service for the loss of this institution in our,
right,
community. And it was just really incredible to sort of hear people shouting out that I was damned and things like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it didn't all go away. It's largely not visible today in any extent, but it still was. And that would have been in the 90s.
I wonder if it has any impact, even if it is visible today. I mean, occasionally you see those folks on campus, and I'm getting ahead of myself.
Sure,
but
go ahead.
You know, the younger generation on campus today, mm-hmm, I think, has a different perspective.
Oh, yes.
And
right,
you know, I don't see people engaging that person or those folks when they come. I see people just kind of going about their business,
right,
and ignoring. And
right,
it's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we jaded? Are we so acclimated to it? Or do we just not give it any attention because we don't think it's important?
I think we feel secure enough that we can ignore it. It was interesting to me, jumping sort of way ahead, on the constitutional amendment fight this past year, was the ability in this community to get business folks, such as Downtown Madison and the Chamber of Commerce, to come out against the constitutional amendment prohibiting,
mm-hmm,
gay marriage. And we tried to get some of those business folks in Milwaukee, just could not do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I mean, it was a sign of where we were in standing in the community and where we were seated at tables, that we could engage that discussion and that people would respect it and understand,
mm-hmm,
that it was an important thing for us who were part of their community. You know, not true elsewhere around the state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the vote reflected that,
sure,
too,
sure,
but in terms of the institutional response. And yet, I tried to get sort of Republicans for Fair Wisconsin, see if I could get a statement organized. I'd been involved in getting the Wisconsin former governors to make a statement, and got,
mm-hmm,
through Tony Earle for the former governors to come out against the amendment. But when I tried to knock on doors of Republicans who I had known and worked with, they listened politely, but none of them really came through. And, you know, not that I think many of them might not have voted against the amendment in the end, but for them, they couldn't do that public community acceptance that the business community could. So, I mean, it was still a gradation,
mm-hmm,
even at that point.
It's an interesting distinction.
Right. Now, you know, they're tied into sort of a political marriage, so to speak, with a,
right,
you know, religious group, but for the most part, they weren't that so tied here in Madison, but their statewide associations would have prohibited.
Yet the business owners were completely comfortable, or more comfortable.
More comfortable. And,
yeah,
the, you know, they didn't really have something to lose, and they had something to gain, and they might have lost if they hadn't done the endorsement.
Yeah.
But the political folks just couldn't go there publicly.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting, it showed me how far the light had moved and yet where it had not moved
right.
at the same
in
time.
In many ways it's moved so, quite a bit, in some
right.
ways not at all.
Right,
yeah.
right. And then, you know, obviously the votes here were overwhelming, but
right.
they were still votes
yeah.
for the amendment.
Yeah.
So, you
yeah.
know.
It wasn't 100%.
No.
So. Let's back up.
Sure.
One of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit more today was the New Harvest Foundation.
Sure.
If you want to maybe back up and revisit that and
okay.
talk a little bit about how that was formed, what
okay.
your involvement was, and what impact that organization has had in the community.
Sure. I had been approached back in the late 70s to be on the board for the Gay Center.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an advisory board. There was sort of a real formal board for the center, but this was sort of an advisory board. They were trying to reach out to some folks. And I said yes. I hadn't really been particularly involved with the center beforehand. When we were looking at their budget, I was just amazed at their lack of revenue, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest revenue was from operating the coat check at the gay bar. Which, needless to say, was not a gold mine. So myself and a friend of mine, Dan Curd, ended up throwing, we first threw a Key West party in the late 70s, and then later we threw a Castro Street party. And, I mean, you know, we were just barring gay themes for
right,
fundraisers,
right,
house
right,
parties.
Right.
But we had printed invites, we had great food, we, you know, did some decorations and stuff like that. And, you know, I think we raised significant amounts, and whether it was, you know, a couple thousand or so, it was more than they had seen at any one time,
sure.
time before. But it sort of began to reveal to me the tenuous nature of funding for community organizations. The other source of funding that the center had, because they did the sort of the gay hotline, was
mm-hmm.
city money, which
mm-hmm.
was often threatened by people who wanted to cut
sure.
frivolities out of the budget. And so we knew that there was a need. The other thing is that I got involved in, you know, just sort of people would start knocking on my door that we're bringing a gay playwright to town and they couldn't quite pay for his plane ticket, and would I throw a cocktail party to raise some money for this? And
yeah,
I said,
yeah.
sure. So I, you know, I ended up throwing a cocktail party.
Right, right.
You know, so, but the haphazard nature of this sort of impressed me. And so, a number of us started to talk, and then and there happened to be a fundraiser in town who was gay, but professional experience, and Jerry Dahlke. And so he and a number of us started to sit down. We spent about 6 months of meetings in my living room, about
mm-hmm.
once a month or so, and tried to think about the issues of how we would do fundraising and create a gay nonprofit foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And Carla Dubinsky, who went off and worked in the Justice Department and was an attorney, was very involved in that, and a whole bunch of other people. And part of the questions, and there were some other examples that we knew of gay fundraising in town. One of them was the Magic Picnic, which was a big summer picnic.
At Brittingham.
Brittingham Park.
Mm-hmm.
And organizations would commit to so many volunteer hours, and then they got so much of the proceeds. Again, the dollars weren't much. It was a little haphazard. There was always sort of a sense, well, this group needs it more than that group,
yeah.
and this sort of stuff. And why should you do it? Now, some other experiences that I had, was that I had been on the Wisconsin Arts Board. I'd been involved in the County Cultural Affairs Commission. And so I had begun to see how organizations actually asked for money,
mm-hmm.
and more substantial money,
mm-hmm.
Rather than sort of, you know, we are more entitled than you are, and therefore we need the money. I mean, some of the rationales for divvying up money within the community or why people ought to contribute were just off-putting to say, rather than contributing.
Yeah.
So one of them was, well, you know, isn't it about time the community would grow up and learn to ask for money like everybody else, and then we could ask for some of that same kind of money,
yeah,
rather than assume we had to get it from Coach Epics or Picnics.
Right.
So part of the discussions that we had was, how do we enhance both the fundraising ability of the community and enhance their professionalism at the same time, and try and make the connection into some of the straight funding streams.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things that we talked a lot about, and this was in like 83, 84, was, would people feel comfortable writing a check to something that said Gay Foundation? And basically a lot of people said no.
Really?
They didn't think people would.
Interesting.
So
even in Madison?
Even in Madison. Mm-hmm. And most of there were a couple other gay foundations around the country. And Milwaukee had recently formed the Cream City Foundation,
mm-hmm,
which was related to its Cream City Business Association.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they had used a name, Cream City, that was non-gay specific.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true of most of the foundations around. So we also came to the conclusion that it ought to be not specifically denominated gay.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up, after struggling long and hard on the name New Harvest, and
which is a bakery.
Well, we were actually playing like with the Dome Foundation or the Capitol one, you know, something that
right.
was related to Madison.
Right.
Then we looked at the state seal, and there's this cornucopia of mm-hmm. stuff coming out. And so I'm sure it was Carla Dubinsky who came up, well, why not New Harvest? I mean, you know, we're talking about
right.
trying to create a new kind of climate for
right.
ourselves in this community. And so in lieu of anybody coming up with anything better in the end, that's what we settled on. And it was very funny, because when we applied to the IRS for our tax exemption, we had people who had experience in that, they did all these documents.
Mm-hmm.
The IRS made it clear we could not make any pretense that we were doing agricultural pursuits, that they did not want to have anybody misled. Now, this was in the Reagan days, too. We didn't
right.
even know if we would get
right.
a tax exempt.
And they were more worried about
right,
your
right.
misleading
right,
farmers.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
And actually, when you think of Troy's question about Will Fellow's book on farm boys,
right.
it would have been misleading at all. So, anyway, after all this time, the other thing that we made, in addition to sort of not having a specific gay name, was that we also wanted to have what we termed OSs, or ostensible straights, on the board of the foundation, so that people wouldn't feel that if they were part of it, that they were automatically identifying themselves as gay or lesbian.
Oh, interesting.
So, by having a mixed board, we could let people join the board without having to say that they were gay or lesbian.
Right.
So,
provide that sort of
cover
anonymity
right.
for those that weren't
right.
quite comfortable yet.
Right. And again, the way we got the cover was that we asked people in the political community who we knew and who owed us some things, like Mary Louise Simon, who had been a county board chair,
mm-hmm.
And James Doyle Jr., who was then the district attorney and now governor,
yeah.
To be on our board. Additionally, Jerry Dahlke, as I said, was a professional fundraiser. He had helped Joe Sensenbrenner do fundraising. So he got Joe Sensenbrenner for our kickoff event, which we held at the old Civic Center marquee room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we were saying, hey, we're mainline, we're going, you know, in a public place, uptown
sure.
kind
right.
of a thing, rather than sort of, you know, in a back dingy
hiding
bar or something, right,
yeah.
right, you know, where people say the password and come in.
Right, right.
Not the price flag. Anyway, but we were, you know, we were trying to put a very different presence. We had also discussed, and we knew that in other gay communities around the state, they sort of had big community dinners where
mm-hmm.
people in the community came.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison didn't have any of that at that point. And, you know, we had an Urban League dinner or an NAACP dinner, but there was nothing for the community. And so,
mm-hmm.
again, that was one of the things that we wanted to do, a place where, in part, the community could be validated by itself coming together and by getting recognition from other mm-hmm. folks in the community by coming to, quote, our annual.
Right.
The way they go to
a large public,
right.
know, fancy event or
right,
a
right,
ball
right,
or
right, right.
gala.
And, you know, it was, and then now it's sort of like a Minot Terrace, like everything else. It's rubber chicken and all that stuff. But, you know, it's good rubber chicken. But
it's mainstream.
Right, right, it is. But I mean, the first time we did it, we actually rented the whole fest and had the whole fest. And, you know, we were doing a little bit slightly more offbeat. Fabulous,
yeah.
we would have thought at the time.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But we were, you know, trying to fill a couple of those voids. The other thing, and I may have mentioned this last time, was that we knew most of us who were in the meetings didn't really use the services of most of the community institutions,
mm-hmm.
but that we were sort of the middle class folks who had a little bit more resources who could give to that,
right?
And could give in a more structured way.
Mm-hmm.
And if we knew it wasn't just somebody at the last minute calling up and say, oh gosh, we don't have a plane ticket for a gay playwright who's coming, but somebody who was being disciplined enough to write an application to justify mm-hmm. it would give us an evaluation.
Right.
That it was a better way to talk to donors of what we were doing. And it was a better way to train the organizations so that they could not only go after our money, but after other money as well.
And yeah.
You know, and today the New Harvest just transferred its corpus of its endowment to the Madison Community Foundation.
Wow.
So it's part of, it still keeps, it makes the decisions,
right.
but it doesn't have to manage that stuff. So
that's
I mean,
nice.
Again, an example of the kind of mainstreaming that
yeah,
has
progress.
Occurred. Right. So, and again, relatively short time comparatively.
Yeah, it was 20 years,
happen.
Really.
Right.
What sorts of initiatives did you fund or sort of coordinate early on?
We started to do some early AIDS things because it was starting back then, unfortunately.
When did that first really impact Madison?
The first statewide case, as I recall, occurred in either late 83 or early 84, because we had formed the Governor's Council in 83, and it wasn't the first thing that we dealt with, but we knew we would have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first case came out of Appleton that was publicized. And
in 83?
Either 83 or 84. It's either late 83 or early 84. It wasn't, the, as I said, the very first thing that
right.
we were doing, but very quickly it became what
it became
we did.
A focus.
Yeah. So, and I have all those records piled in boxes.
Yeah.
And there were some early counseling efforts being done here for folks. Initially, some of the folks that we had were people who were returning here. And this was true of many other sort of communities, is that because the disease had struck more on the coast or people who had been on the coast,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes there were people returning here after they had become infected rather than necessarily initially infections coming here locally. So,
oh, interesting.
And so some people had begun to do counseling and some then testing Blue Bus
mm-hmm.
and other things. And so those were sort of the very first things that were happening. They were sort of projects of other folks initially until the AIDS Network was formed, and then that became more focused for it. But there was, I think early on, the Gay Chorus, that might have changed names over those years,
mm-hmm.
Was one of the things. Kissing Girls Productions was still around and they were doing their things at that point. And, you know, couple hundred dollars for them or a thousand, you know, might help them get equipment that
oh,
they
yeah,
could really use
huge.
To, you know. You know, it was very early things. You know, today they've gotten into sort of helping the listen folks and all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a lot of community nurturing
yeah.
of what it was, of sort of very fledgling institutions then.
And I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself as well, but you're thinking about some of those early efforts in the New Harvest Foundation
mm-hmm.
and everything that kind of grew out of it. How would you contrast that kind of community organization in the 80s to what you see today on campus or in the Madison community? How has that sort of grassroots or
mm-hmm.
sort of, and it may not even be fledgling anymore, how has that sort of community participation changed over the years?
Boy, it's a whole lot. Let me, one more thing for the beginning of New Harvest.
Okay.
When we were trying to sell the idea, we had originally sort of had a group of folks who had been meeting, we had an initial board, And then we went out to people like Rodney Scheel, who had the New Bar, you know, was one of the most successful gay entrepreneurs in town. And he was extremely dubious that we could pull this off.
Why is that?
He thought, well, you never get the gay professionals in town, the lawyers and doctors and those kinds of folks to serve on the board.
Interesting.
That they just didn't think, you know, you would get them to do that. I mean, Rodney could get them all to go party down at his bars or take them on bus trips to Chicago for, you know, wild sort of weekends and stuff like that. But thinking of them as responsible citizens, no, he couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And other people were dubious too, but I remember Rodney particularly because we had a special lunch to try and court him.
Yeah,
because we figured he's making money; he ought to be contributing.
Precisely.
But in the end, today there's no question that people are willing to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, for a while we were sort of cycling within a circle of folks who were related to, you know, us who had founded. And so, you know, we would serve sort of two terms and then get one of our friends to serve, you know. But today it's a much broader kind of a group. You know, you go to its dinners, there's folks I hardly know. And when we had the first thing at the fest, I knew almost everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just sort of beyond that small circle of folks. And
is
folks,
it as effective, do you think?
They're still raising money. They haven't quite kicked to the, you know, next mega level. I mean, some of the organizations in the community, you know, have grown in part because they've needed to, whereas others are established, but they, you know, there's no mega kind of status for some things. The AIDS Network is probably one which isn't technically, you know, it's a related but not specifically a community one. But part of the question is, you know, how much perceived need is there today still in that regard?
That's a good question.
You know, the people sort of theorize about sort of a post-gay world that, you know, in some ways that the integration into larger communities is so much easier that the identity questions that we had to deal with, the fact that you needed separate support systems may not be there. I don't know the answer to that.
No, but I've heard the same argument with women's issues as well.
Right.
You know.
Right. And I don't think it's true in either case myself, but it could be argued.
False complacency.
Yes, right. There certainly is a lot of that. So, you know, today I'm involved with a group at the University Foundation trying to raise money for gay studies and the campus center.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, clearly the people that we're aiming at who have some resources, again, are the kind of people who went through very identifying experiences coming out and being part of a community. And so, you know, we're creating some name scholarships and other kinds of things as part of that effort. But to the kids today, I don't know. I mean, they have a different sense. I mean, I talked to the students who went on this bus trip recreating the early gay civil rights era. And there was a panel of a couple of us who spoke to them before they went, and then I saw a little video they put together after their trip.
Mm-hmm.
It's just remarkable. It's not anything we could have imagined in our day.
So, why is that?
One, the bus trip was both gay and straight students talking about a gay topic. I mean, you were lucky if you could talk about a gay topic with gay people, much less really have discussions about it in any depth. They actually had resources like books, and then they did some oral history interviews and things like that. You know, people weren't afraid to be on video and stuff like that. And so, I mean, it clearly was a different world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not still questions of identity that they're dealing with, but it's a much different world. After the Governor's Council on Gay and Lesbian Issues was appointed, I got invited to go speak to the Wisconsin Press Association. They were having their annual meeting, I believe, up at Stevens Point. And, you know, they were asking, well, you know, how do we deal with gay news? I mean, because it was relatively new to them in the state of how to deal with this. And this was after the controversy that occurred with Ron McCrae, where the Milwaukee Sentinel had announced his appointment with, you know, governor who appoints a vowed homosexual as a big headline.
Right.
And, you know, they got badly trounced for that by journalists for sort of, you know, making this kind of
inflamed.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the journalists wanted to know how, you know, should they deal with issues? How do they find sources and this sort of stuff? And, you know, so trying to sort of give them some information about how to do that, how to sort of approach folks, and you know, it was new, and they didn't know how to do it. And you know, now you wouldn't presume that at all. You would figure that, you know,
if it's not gay news, it's news.
Well, none of that, but that if you're a reporter and you want to cover gay news, one, you know how to do it, and two, you can find sources, because you can pull up the book and usually find something, or you can ask somebody about, you know, who do I call to get something on this, you know. They didn't know at that point. I mean, you know, originally they thought all the gay people were in San Francisco and New York, and, you know, then they discovered there were some of us in Madison and Milwaukee, but if you're in Stevens Point or Eau Claire, I mean, how do you handle something, and how do you begin to understand it and this sort of stuff? So, you know, changed a world. I mean, if you look at the coverage that existed on the Fair Wisconsin and the amendment and the campaign, you know, they all had developed local sources. They all knew how to run stories and this sort of thing. So, but wasn't that world back in the 80s?
No.
So,
let's talk a little bit about that, because it's very interesting to me. We talked about, you know, AIDS being a defining issue in the 80s. You know, in the 90s, there was still that. You know, what I see as sort of the defining issue of this decade is probably the marriage amendment.
Right.
What else has been sort of on the forefront, at least in Madison or in your involvement with the community, besides those two issues?
In some ways, there was sort of the repeal. The first thing was really the repeal of the city gay rights law. That was the first big battle, non-discrimination. And then there was the push for the state law, which was passed. And then sort of its enforcement. And then after that sort of thing settled down, in Madison, there was community building, but there wasn't a lot of controversial issues that I'm thinking about till sort of Tammy's election.
Really?
And, you know, and again, I live in a political world, and Madison is a political town, so that to elect for Congress somebody who was, you know, openly gay was remarkable. And Tammy was very clear about emphasizing about making history. And so you know, I think that was important. I mean, David ran for Congress, but David had so muddled issues about his own identity that, you know, people were very split about how to deal with David and identity questions. So
it wasn't quite as cut and dried as
Tammy. Well, it wasn't cut and dried at all.
Yeah.
He was married at the time, you know, and many people were upbraiding him for that. I mean, I had maintained my friendship with David through all of his changes in his life. But many people had sort of broken bridges and all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
So his run for Congress, and where he didn't even win the primary, you know, was not seen that same way, whereas Tammy had been so solid and clear about her.
Unwavering.
Right.
Yeah.
She was. And involved with things in the community in terms of the county AIDS efforts and things like that, that it really was historic. And, you know, to think of that here in this town, we had passed the first gay rights law in the early 80s. And we had then elected the first out lesbian and first, frankly, out gay person who was elected without being elected first and then coming out.
Right.
You know, it's sort of a remarkable place. And so it speaks to sort of part of what we were able to do in terms of building political institutions and support. One of the other things on the New Harvest Foundation was that, you know, I mean, I don't divorce one side of my brain from the other, in that I knew for political campaigns, fundraising was an important part.
Huge.
And you had to train people to give.
Right.
And the New Harvest Foundation was another way to train people to give, to build a cadre of people who would be skilled in asking. You could take those same people from a New Harvest milieu and put them instead into a political campaign, and you had another asset for a political campaign, right.
So the New Harvest Foundation really served so many purposes for the community. And that education, I think, was critical in being able to achieve some of the successes that the community can claim, which I think is fair to say. You know, Tammy owes a lot of her success probably to that that organizing unit.
And there were a lot of people who were her key fundraisers who had been involved in New Harvest in its various stages. So, these things do link, and some of us were purposeful about the potential links.
It wasn't just serendipitous.
No.
was a plan.
There was a plan.
The whole
thing about the Hominturn and, making sure that we all supported one another and that those kinds of links were there and things like that, too. It was about building community and building political power, which in this community made sense and which was possible to do. Milwaukee finally has some out gay people, but it took them decades to follow us.
I still think Madison is Madison. I mean, there are places outside of our city and within the state or the country that aren't quite as far along as we are.
Oh, without a doubt.
Without a doubt. I keep thinking as we're talking, and I kind of touched on this already, it's so different. The experience for young people today is so different for so many reasons. The climate is different, but people are also connected in very different ways. And we live in a very global, globally connected world.
Right.
How do you get, or what are your thoughts on how community building has grown or evolved and changed because of that sort of differently connected nature of communication?
Right.
You know, kids aren't as connected perhaps with their own peers on campus as they are with somebody in Great Britain or Australia. And, and how do you envision sort of community building changing or evolving because of that?
I'm not sure, but I know it's a reality. I'm an historian, so I do know that sort of local institutions were a lot more important in the past than they are today. Today, Logo Channel on cable probably has as much influence, or magazines. When I was first in the early 80s trying to find media sources, mainly it was The Advocate, which still had its infamous pink pages back then as a separate pullout. You could get rid of it if you wanted. So the fact that you could have sort of mainstream sources and lots of magazine choices and, most of them not even caring about the politics of stuff, more about fashion and travel and all kinds of other things that generate more advertising revenue for folks. And that thinking about sort of even local gay media, which Madison has had a fitful experience with off and on, and then sort of the folks who did the Wisconsin Light out of Milwaukee, which they tried to keep statewide. Past year I went to the funeral for Jerry Johnson, or Terry Bergner rather. He with Jerry Johnson were the people who did the Wisconsin Light. Is that those local things are breaking down. They're not gone. They're still local cultures. There's still some local media. The Cap Times going away. It's another example of one. Again, having a paper like the Cap Times that was interested in covering gay issues was an important thing. Today the State Journal will, but back then hardly ever would have covered things. So, each of the local TV stations is known to have a gay person on their staff.
Yeah.
But I don't think TV covers as much gay news just because of the nature of what they do.
Right.
You know, if they're a celebrity host for gay drag bingo, maybe they do a little story on that. But
right.
I don't think they cover much otherwise. So in some ways, how you build and keep identity in a community is a little more challenging when, one, you don't have the outside pressures to sort of isolate you, and some of the institutional support that used to be there goes away. There is a change just in the very nature of sort of our public discourse and public dialogue and public space today because of the mm-hmm. absorption in media
mm-hmm.
and how you access it. So it's going to affect our community as well.
Yeah. And for better or for worse, I mean, I think there are very positive aspects of that.
Oh, yeah, sure,
think,
absolutely.
You know,
because, I mean, if you're in some isolated place,
you have something.
You have something you can read about. I mean, you know, Harvey Milk's famous speech about, you know, he got a call from the young kid in Altoona, and mm-hmm. you know, the kid had nowhere to go except to call somebody in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know? Well, now I'm sure there must be a GLSEN teen thing in Altoona, at least, if not, you know, four or five other places. So
websites.
Right.
Or,
right.
You know.
Right. He can get on the computer and go find him. So.
Right.
So. A different world and more resources available. So it's just, you know, it's not better or worse, it's just different.
Yeah. So when you look back on all of these experiences and you know, each decade has been very different for you, mm-hmm. you know, what stands out in your mind is perhaps, and this is kind of a loaded question, but perhaps maybe your proudest accomplishments or the thing that maybe at the time didn't seem like it was going to be such a big deal, but it's turned out to be, you know, something that's really changed mm-hmm. your experience in the community for better?
I think by being an out public official, that's still one of the more significant things that I did, because I think it did pave the way for other folks to come along, that broader network of, quote, the Hamantern,
mm-hmm.
And for eventually Tammy to come along.
Mm-hmm.
And that also encouraged a whole bunch of other folks in town to do things and stand up and sort of, you know, find that, you know, the sky wasn't going to collapse if they did. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were able to do, as a result, New Harvest, we were able to get other people to do it. I mean, you know, just the fact that you could do that in this town in the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
I think was, and you know, it enabled Governor Earle then to appoint Kathleen and I as his co-chairs of the Governor's Council, and it wasn't seen as sort of that extreme that he could appoint two elected officials to
mm-hmm.
to do this effort. So I still think that was probably the single most significant thing for all of this other work that I've been engaged in.
Where do you see yourself contributing, participating, moving forward, looking ahead? You touched on a couple of the
sure.
work things that you've been involved in, the marriage amendment most recently,
right.
but
right. If I can discipline myself to write my work on Wisconsin gay history, you know, I think that could be useful. I mean, I've lived through a lot of it, so I could write some of the more recent parts, which you got to get detachment, but I still
right.
have some good sources for some of the most recent. But I also think I can frame some of it in ways that are interesting.
So?
I've done most of the research for the Oscar Wilde trial coverage in the Wisconsin Press at this
mm-hmm.
point. And so it's almost all negative, to say the least. The ones that aren't negative are maybe neutral at
mm-hmm.
best. And so from it you can draw the themes that I can imagine, not only what this says about the attitudes of the white male editors who were writing the headlines and who were writing the editorials, but you can think about it that if you happen to be somebody who might have been gay or homosexual reading these things, you know, what do you draw from it? I mean, one, you're going to get public shame, you're going to be involved in the criminal justice system, you're going to be financially harmed, you know, the actual penalties are going to be severe. I mean, there's all these things that they choose to cover out of the trial, in which they report. They encourage censorship, that is, books and plays ought to be banned and all these things. And yet, several of them, not all of them by any means, but several of them chose to publish the final statement that Wilde makes at the trial. He basically writes it out, a couple paragraphs, after he's been convicted and sentenced and before they sort of take him away. And I call it Oscar's antidote. Mm-hmm. And in it, he shifts the experience away from the criminal justice thing, away from sex. And he talks about it as still a matter of beauty. So he's in his own tradition of, you know, what is aesthetic. And he still is talking about it as a positive kind of thing. So that if you have to go and read all this negative thing, read all the characterizations, you still hear have Oscar himself saying, no, you all got it wrong. It's not about those things. It's really about beauty and love and relation and, you know. So maybe you can reach out for that little bit of hope. If you read, if you happen to be in a town that publishes that part of this, the story. So.
And why do you think those few editors did choose to publish?
Well, I mean, it was news, it was a statement, you know. I mean, I don't think that they were thinking of it in the same way that I'm thinking.
Perhaps.
Of it, you know.
It was the end of the story.
And then the stories themselves come from London, so the editors can truncate it, that they don't make it up. The headlines they make up, so the headlines are clearly more reflective of their attitudes.
Interesting.
You know, so for some of them, I think it's simply a matter of journalism that this is what they got from London. It was sort of, you know, part of the reportage that
news feed.
That they did dead it out, thank goodness. So so anyway, I mean, you know, those kinds of constructions that you can bring to it, I think, are an interesting kind of way to view it.
So your own personal history of LGBT in Wisconsin, and then
And I, you know, I just because of the nature of it, I've picked up some sources. The house that I live in was inhabited by two gay men in the 1950s and 60s, and it was sort of the gay social center of Madison back in that decade. And one of them was a newspaper reporter for a small weekly journal, the Rio Journal. But he was a writer. He went off and studied briefly at Taliesin. And so, I mean, he has this connection to all kinds of stuff. But the niece of his partner dropped off a bunch of his writings from the presumably 20s and 30s. So I have a wonderful source material of his sort of gay stories and kinds of things like that from that period in poems. He only published one little poem called Two Venetian Goblets. But when you think of sort of the slightly underground life that they were having to live, but they were pretty above ground for being underground. But still, he describes in the Two Venetian Goblets the kind of fragileness of the glass. And if you take that as a metaphor for the fragileness of the lives that they were living in 1950s Wisconsin, the time of the McCarthy era. You know, it's like a wonderful kind of revelatory kind of poem.
So it's another project for you. It's another project for you.
Well, yes, this is all part of this, this project, you know, which I'm still trying to do while trying to do commuter rail and being on boards here and there, and, you know, so, but it's very interesting. And, you know, just having some of this sort of, and I have a 1911 book of physical culture that one of the neighbors on my block had that I picked up in a neighborhood block sale. So, I mean, just my own life, I've come across some very interesting sources, and I know there's going to be more out around the state as well. So, gathering those and trying to weave those in a story so that some of that gets told.
Yeah. What will you do with those materials when you're done?
I hope it's a book in the end. So the materials, I'm sure, I mean, I started donating papers already to the Historical Society. So,
okay.
But presumably I'll give them all the rest of the garage full of stuff. Yeah. Or if you guys want to argue for it, I don't know.
Well, you know, it's an interesting aside, though. You know, we're doing the project with Michael Doylen at UW-Milwaukee, and mm-hmm. he's got, you know, a groundswell of material, you know, documenting community and activism there. And,
right. I know the Milwaukee stuff exists.
You know, and we're going to digitize it. We're going to make it available online.
Right.
Who knows?
Oh, wow.
So
you're going to take this stuff too and make it available?
We are.
Ooh.
We are. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay.
It's a lot of oral histories, too.
Right. Well, in my Fair Wisconsin work, I ran across somebody who knows somebody who's working on a history of the Maine Club up in Superior, which mm-hmm. has been the chief institution for that community for years. And Troy connected me with this guy in La Crosse who has copies of all of their publications and things like that. So, you know, so there are sources out there. And, you know, in a way, and this is something I don't know if I could pull off, but it's sort of what I'm thinking is that, one, there's just a story of the community and its people to be told. But two, there's something about, you know, the first gay rights state, the first out lesbian elected, plus we had Gunderson come out while he was in office, so, you know, the first out Republican congressperson. And can you say something about the interaction of that community and its political culture that explains some of that in ways that draw on sort of that uniqueness of what this state was in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and how it does provide for this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I would think so.
I would think so too. At least I'd love to speculate on it. So that's.
I'd love to read it.
Right. So.
But I know where you're going. It's,
right.
It's a tough thing to bring all that together.
Right. It is.
What haven't we touched on? Is there anything that, you know, we've covered a lot of your experiences with different organizations
mm-hmm.
and on campus.
Right.
You know, we didn't talk much about the historic Madison preservation work.
Right.
Is there anything that you would like to share about that organization and your participation?
Again, it sort of represented where I lived when I was in graduate school, because I lived in the Mansion Hill area.
Mm-hmm.
And I got engaged in that work while living in the neighborhood. And since doing that, I learned a lot about Madison history mm-hmm. and served on the Landmarks Commission and all that stuff. I didn't publish it, but when I was president of Historic Madison, I pushed that we would publish the Journal of Historic Madison
mm-hmm.
and actually contributed one article on the sort of loss of public buildings in Madison, that we used to have a lot more that were publicly functional buildings, fire stations and things like that we just sort of thrown away.
Gas stations.
So that kept me involved in local history in a way, so mm-hmm. when the Madison sesquicentennial as a city came along, the mayor tapped me to be on that and then asked me to head it up as well. And so, you know, I've continued to sort of have a play in local history, though I don't have the depth that certainly a David Mulhoff or anybody that like that does, but some people come and talk to me about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the preservation stuff really led me into sort of planning issues, which led me into a lot of the issues with the city and how it's planned. So that in part got me involved in doing the conferences on John Nolan and the new urbanism, which we did three of, Mark Eisen being the chief instigator behind that. But I brought some organizational skills and other mm-hmm. issues to that as well. And so I've been involved, and still am, because I'm on the Urban Design Commission, in planning issues and sort of the development of the city and how that fits. And
mm-hmm.
so those are, again, some very interesting issues and related to transportation and the other stuff I'm doing. So that's been another focus of a lot of my public activity and involvement. We didn't talk much about the Gay Alum Association. Mm. Tammy and I were both involved in the early days of founding that. And I think we were one of the first in the Big Ten with one of the most ongoing ones, but I think some have come and gone in other parts of the Big Ten.
Really?
And so, you know, Paula Bonner was a big credit to helping get that going, mm-hmm. sustaining that. And, you know, again, I think that helps build issues. I've certainly known people on campus who've been involved in some of the issues. Oh, there was another issue on campus, which was the ROTC issue, which I forgot about, which I wasn't involved in directly.
What is that?
This was when they were trying to get ROTC off campus because of the military policy against gay and lesbians serving in the military. And so there was a big effort, particularly by a number of faculty members. Joe Elder was one. Mike Olnick, whose wedding I was in, was another. And so that was supported by people in the community, but it was really a campus issue and various votes in the Faculty Senate on the issue and stuff like that.
Were they successful? Hmm?
No, ROTC is still here.
Yeah.
You know, they pushed very strongly against the military policy and, you know, continue to, I think, lay the groundwork, which they and other people have done on other campuses, so that, you know, at some point, don't ask, don't tell is going to go away.
Yeah.
But again, you ended up with a federal issue more than what you could manage in the state arena or within the local campus arena.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly that was a significant issue.
So the '90s, early 90s.
Something.
Clinton, right?
No, actually it was before Clinton. As far as I can recall, because when Clinton got in, he knew he wanted to try and do something about it, and that's what led to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But the campus pressure was occurring in the late 80s.
Right.
So the other issue, which was sort of the city domestic partner issue, mm-hmm. I was not on the city council, but certainly a number of my friends were, and so they turned to me to try and help see if could mediate sort of something that would get a council majority between some of the folks who were most insistent on, and I don't even remember the particulars anymore, but I can remember meeting with a number of the straight alders and trying and helping sort out some of the issues for them and get them to a place where the city could do something on domestic partners. And they did, and they mm-hmm. do have a domestic partner policy for the city.
Is it the same policy that's still in place now?
Probably. It may have been strengthened a little bit over the years. Mm-hmm. But that was an issue during the 80s when I was on the county board that I was able to help mm-hmm. the other side of the house, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Some of my friends who were on the city council used to refer to the county board as the House of Lords, so they were the House of Commons if that was the case.
That's very nice.
So, I mean, you know, you live in the political world and you're able to deal with it even if it's not your own direct kind of way of doing it. So,
do you feel like Madison is still kind of ahead of the curve?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Compared to sort of peer cities around the country?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you know, one of the issues here has been, and this is sort of one of the perplexing things in thinking about sort of the history of the state and this place, is that you don't need to ghettoize or build separate community institutions. You can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly there are a few areas, you know, in the city, Dyke Heights and Boys by the Bay and stuff like that, where people have congregated, but it hasn't been necessary the way it occurred in some other places.
Yeah.
So there's much more flowing back and forth. You know, even the new gay bars supposedly floating around town are having various issues, and, you know, someday they'll either sort it out or they won't, but it's more of an entrepreneur issue than a community issue.
Yeah. Why is that, do you think, in Madison, that there's less need to sort of ghettoize?
Well, part of it is because I think when the straight community is more open, and that there's more self-assurance that you can go there. You know, most of my circle of friends are gay, but I have a number of gay friends, most of their circle are not gay.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they feel very comfortable with that. You know, so
it's a much more fluid environment, isn't
right,
it?
Right, it is. And, you know, theoretically, that's how we always wanted it to be.
Right. And now
so it is. It is. Yeah. And so, you know, it's actually not bad, as it turns out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it doesn't lend yourself as much for, you know, cutting edge kind of internal focused kinds of efforts. You know, that's why the political stuff probably has been more valuable and achievable here, because it is both externally focused and engages those allies that you have, rather than relying on community power to do it.
Right.
Anybody who was elected, of the gay officials I've been talking to, none of them had a gay majority district, whereas in other places around the country, you start getting not quite gay majority, but substantial gay, you know, communities that are electing the openly gay people.
Right.
Wasn't the experience here. They were elected from, you know, ostensibly straight districts.
Yeah.
To use that other term. So, you know, it's a different kind of experience.
Do you think, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot since we started this interview, or the first interview, you know, were you to share, and you probably have, your experience, your coming out experience, mm-hmm. your community involvement experience with young people today, do you mm-hmm. think they really have an appreciation for all the experiences that have occurred over the past several decades to allow them to have the experience that they're having today? Do you think they have a cognizance of the environment for you compared to the environment for them?
Nobody does. Nobody does. And it's not just gay things.
Yeah.
You know, I hang around antique stores with friends, and you know, I come across things from World War II. I was born in 43, so I'm a kid of the war.
Yeah.
And like, there's patriotic songbooks, you know, that are just part of sort of the culture of that period. I come across ration books. Mm-hmm. You know, those things fascinate me,
right,
because they speak to a very different mm-hmm. world than the one I grew up, starting later in the 50s and
right.
60s, knew. So I don't think, you know, they can. You just can't track back to,
right.
to that stuff. I'm fascinated by old atlases, particularly. I have a number that come from World War II era, and mm-hmm. so you see how they're depicting the world, and then how the world looks, you know, in 2008.
Right.
It's, you know, very different. And, you
we're
know,
really talking about engaging kids in history.
Right.
And personalizing their own history so that they have a greater appreciation for that experience, whatever it is.
Right, and some of them will like history and have an ability to understand it, and some of them won't care and don't want to.
Don't
so,
know.
You know, that's part of the reality of,
sure.
of where they are. So,
sure.
But for those who want to be able to preserve the resources and to sort of have them available and let them know about them, is an important thing.
Well,
so.
It's why we do what we do.
Right.
It's critical.
Right.
Well, I don't really have any other specific questions
okay.
today.
That's
if there's
fine.
Anything else that you
okay.
wanted to talk about, I think what I'll do is
sure.
sit down with Troy and kind of go over what we talked about today, and if
okay.
there are other follow-up questions that he might have,
sure.
we might do
That's
another
fine.
Quick.
Okay, if you feel free, but I mean, we've covered a lot.
We have covered a lot. I'm going to stop now.